I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, actor Richard Thomas talks about capturing real family life on stage. Thomas plays Eric Blake in the touring production of the Tony Award-winning play, The Humans. The action occurs in real time as a family of two grown daughters, their 60-something parents, and their grandmother meet for Thanksgiving at one daughter's rough around the edges apartment. Audiences laugh in recognition of the many moments in the script when the Blake family reminds them of their own, but there's a dark undertone of anxiety and unfulfilled dreams at work as well. We'll talk with Thomas about the play after a short break. There's a moment in the Tony Award-winning family drama, The Humans, where Eric Blake tells his daughter's boyfriend over Thanksgiving dinner that their family doesn't have any experience with depression. His other daughter agrees, but dryly notes that the Blake family just has a lot of stoic sadness. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That line got a big laugh when I saw the play Tuesday night. And in fact, the script is shot through with things that make us laugh because they constantly conjure thoughts of our own families. But beneath the humor, there is something darker and more despairing. There are health problems, relationship problems, money problems, and a general sense that Blakes have somehow missed out on the kind of prosperity they imagined for themselves and for one another. As Eric Blake, actor Richard Thomas brings a remarkable mixture of intentions and emotions to the character, despite the fact that Eric is not the kind of guy who talks about his feelings. He is the stoic, sad man his daughter described, a longtime high school facilities manager who shows his love by fretting over the condition of his daughter's rundown Chinatown apartment and by taking care of his mother, now fully helpless with dementia. We learn that his stoicism leaves him at night when he is plagued by terrifying nightmares, if he can sleep at all. Richard Thomas has been in hundreds of TV shows, movies, and plays. He played John Boy Walton in the 1970s and recently had a multi-season role on the series The Americans as Agent Frank Gadd. The Humans is in Dallas as part of a national tour. Richard, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be here. Thank you. Boy, you sure did describe that play.
You know? Thank you.
Now I know what it's about. This will be so helpful when I go to the theater tonight.
Well, I've wondered, when you're playing someone who doesn't like to think about his interior life, how do you figure out how to do that when if Eric has these thoughts, he pushes them aside?
Well, everybody has an interior life, but when you're not in conversation with it, it just builds up and eventually, it's going to make itself known, which is really what's happening to Eric. I mean, he's in his early 60s and there are things that have gone on in the family that he's trying to deal with. So many different pressures and so many different challenges, as well as events in the past, including 9/11, and that eventually there's a reckoning, and the unacknowledged and unexamined issues of one's private life can no longer be ignored. And that reckoning is part of what the play is about. But what you say is very true. One of the beautiful things about this play, it's a six-character ensemble piece, even though sort of Eric's particular crisis is the one that may be most salient at times. But one of the things that Stephen Karam, who wrote this play in his mid-30s, if you can believe it. I mean, the intergenerational.
He must understand his parents well.
Well, just the compassion, the understanding he has of both generations. And with that, it would be so easy to just make fun of the kids or make fun of the grown-ups or make fun, to take the easy shot. And they do take shots at each other. Mm-hmm. But underlying that, there's such a sense of acceptance and understanding. It's so beautiful. But the play is so much about each individual, although Eric's, crisis may be the most salient of all of them. Each character in the play is undergoing a crisis and a great challenge. It's like this Buddhist teacher, Jack Kornfield. So I was just trying to remember that every person you meet is undergoing a great crisis and challenge in life, everybody. So the play really talks about how we operate as individuals and how we operate as a community of people, and how we push back against each other and help each other, support each other, how we move forward alone and how we move forward together, hence humans,
But,
But Eric's a great part, and it is, as you, he's a sort of a laconic guy. You know, he's not a talker. He lets his wife sort of carry the social graces, and I think he does have a lot of stoic sadness. For me, this has been a very counterintuitive part because I'm just all over the place. You know, I'm a talker, and I'm, you know, emotionally sort of maybe perhaps a little too present. As a person, so to sort of constrain all that in the performances, Eric has been a wonderful sort of late career challenge for me.
Well, I would imagine you can challenge some of that, you know, talking that you as Richard would do into Eric, because you're also having to embody a lot of physical pain that he's in. Like, nothing that's going to kill him, but his back hurts all the time. He's not sleeping well.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, it's very nice because the age I'm at, you know, I mean, I'm like, okay, I got these pains all the time. So, and sometimes I'm just tired when I get to the theater. So it's a great part because if you're tired and if your arthritis is kicking up, it's just perfect. Don't take those Advil. You can do this play without them and it's really going to help. So every creak and ache and pain that I have, I put into service in this performance.
The fact that everybody here is dealing with something troubling and disappointing, but that it isn't, nothing is fatal in the moment. I mean, we have the grandmother character, and we'll talk about her, but everybody, you get the sense that they're going to be back again next Thanksgiving. If it'll be either in Manhattan or in Scranton or in Philly somewhere, they'll be together again. They'll still be dealing with a version of these problems. And it's really interesting to take a crisis and not necessarily suggest that something extraordinary has changed.
That's right. Because the crisis is always going to be there. One thing will be resolved and something else will pop up. I mean, in terms of nobody's going to be dead, none of it's terminal, I do think that one of the statements the playwright makes at the end, and he's not a big one for making statements, you know, he's not, you know, he never tells you, pay attention because this is what this play's about. It's very beautiful that way. But when that door closes at the end, you really do get a sense that there will come a day when the door will close for everybody. And the play also, in its late moments, takes there's a lot of discussion about religion and about faith in the play. The parents are religious, the kids are not. And the idea of, you know, are we being protected? Are we being looked over? Or are we alone? You know, the numinous aspect of the play comes into focus towards the end, and so it even addresses these questions about is it just this life and that's it, is there another presence that is sharing this with us, and I think it's a very interesting thing because however you would come down on either side of that, that's a question that everybody asks at one point or another. You know, the set, the beautiful, beautiful set design, which is just a sort of bifurcation of this horrendous Chinatown apartment.
With basement the fluorescent apartment. Lighting in the kitchen.
This reminds me of the first apartment I ever had on the Upper West Side when I was a kid. But it's even worse. The sort of bifurcated set, the wonderful, it's like a cross section with a spiral staircase on it, and you watch people go up and down and around, and they're here. It's kind of like watching an ant farm, you know, when you're a kid and you watch these creatures that are doing things and going up and down and being together and being alone and making, and it's sort of that feeling of we're watching humans do what humans do. And sometimes it's hilariously funny, and sometimes it's very sad, and sometimes it's unresolved. It's just a beautiful thing that he's done with this play.
I think the set also reminds you that there are like 42 other families doing their version of this thing, you know, surrounding
yes.
these people that we're watching for
yes,
this night.
Exactly. If you have apartment living as I do in New York, you're always aware that you're in a colony.
So we see this intergenerational cultural divide, and the thing that I think is really poignant for the parents, Eric and Deirdre, is that they have come to the age where they can't solve their daughter's problems anymore. Like,
right.
They have a memory of when, no matter what it was their responsibility to fix it, but they always knew how. And now you have, you know, mom sending care packages that the daughters kind of laugh at. And she's right. forwarding on, you know, dire email warnings of things that could happen to them, right. that sort of thing. They still want to do this thing, but they've lost the power to fix anything.
Well, also for Eric, very specifically, there's another man present. It's not it's not an accident that there are two men in the play, and there are these women, and then there is Eric, and then there is the girlfriend of his younger daughter, who has just moved in with her, and they're living together for the first time. They've just moved into this apartment. So Eric is, you know, in the way of Prospero, about to, you know, sink his staff fathoms deep because his primacy as the sort of, you know, the main male in his daughter's life is changing. And that's something that how Eric comes to terms with Richard, and how Richard is the name of the youngest daughter's boyfriend, and wonderfully played by Luis Vega. It's that sort of valedictory quality of handing it over. It's one of the parts of the play that I really enjoy doing, having three daughters myself, actually having five daughters now.
It's funny because instead of puffing his chest out to show that he used to be, you know, the main man, I mean, the daughters both call him big guy
right.
at times.
Yes.
But what Eric does is go around the apartment sort of noting household maintenance things that right. haven't been done properly.
Right.
Like, you kids need to caulk up here. Like, it's like, don't forget that I still know what's best.
Exactly. He's a maintenance guy. He's been maintaining the family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's been a maintenance man for the family, and his maintenance program has broken down in many ways, and I won't do spoilers. But this loss of power over the parents is very poignant, and we all go through that, you know, as parents. I think there's another there's a conflict between the generations that is very interesting to observe, especially in America today. Right, these young kids, the older parents are people who believe in duty. They go to church, but they feel that you work hard and you get through your problems and you stay together, and that the primary joy of life is fulfilling those duties and those things that you trust. Whereas the younger generation is much more concerned with this wonderful term, self-care. Somebody has to, right? and so the idea of, oh, you have mom, you got to get a manicure, pedicure, you got to take time off, you got to get a little vacation, you got to take care of yourself. I have to get my therapy. How am I going to pay for my therapy? You know, if you can't help me pay for my therapy, or, you know, all of these different ways in which the younger generation of the play looks after itself, which appears to the older people as much more of an indulgence, because they would never indulge themselves in those things. And the author does not come down on the side of either generation, which is one of the things that's so beautiful. He helps you understand the wisdom inherent in both points of view.
Yeah, there's this funny this metaphor of the $25 candle, you know, that the parents are like just appalled that anybody could ask $25 for a candle.
Yeah, like
the get over it.
Like Deirdre, just beautifully played by Pamela Reed, my wife in the play, says you should get five candles for that. I mean, these people are speaking across, they're reaching out to each other across a great divide economically and culturally as well. However, there are beautiful things about what Stephen Karam does. There are acceptances which the love of family places in a higher value than certain other kinds of values. For instance, there's a gay daughter, a lesbian daughter, who is just broken up with her girlfriend of many, many years. And this relationship is not an issue for these parents at all. They love their daughter, and they're sorry for her about the relationship, and the father's encourages her that you'll find somebody else. It's just never an issue for them, the daughter's boyfriend is a man of color, and that's never an issue in the play. It's adhered to, it's sort of referred to once when And he says, my mom's away at the Cape. And she says, what Cape? And the daughter says, Cape Horn, Mom. Which is a joke that actually usually flies right over the audience's heads. But the level of basic acceptance in these areas, I think, is one of the small miracles of the play. Because you see these relationships functioning in spite of all these things that people seem to feel or have historically felt are like the end of civilization as we know it.
My guest is actor Richard Thomas. He plays Eric Blake in the Tony Award-winning play The Humans. We will return to our conversation in 2 minutes. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with actor Richard Thomas. He plays Eric Blake in the Tony Award-winning play The Humans, which is now touring. It takes place over the course of a single Thanksgiving dinner in the life of the Blake family. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You know, we talked about there's some economic differences between the parents and the children, and there are cultural differences. I would argue there are class differences between them, and those are really complicated because that's where I think the resentments of class differences can be even greater than the resentments of different economic statuses.
Oh, I agree. In what aspect did you see those differences manifested in the play? I'm curious because maybe I could address more specifically if you...
I think the assumptions that the daughters have about what they're, although they're not turning out to be that way, you know, I had the sense that they're both better educated than their parents.
Oh, yes. Sure.
And so that creates a chasm right there.
Well, what they've done is they've created, you know, the parents have helped to create this difference. And they, you know, they have devoted themselves to what's best for their children and, you know, and making sure they get an education. And I think they've supported them in every way possibly, and clearly they've supported them personally because of their personal life choices, but they have also set them on a path that will widen the gap, and if that isn't in fact a class gap, you're absolutely right. And then as it turns out, you know, Eric, who is struggling financially, they're struggling a great deal. Part of, you know, they have the care. I mean, there's so much in this play that people are dealing with all across America that the author never hits over the head with a hammer. Mm-hmm. You're just living in the real world of the way people live now without being told, you know, this is what, you know, pay attention to this, pay attention to that.
Like, here's Richard's mother who can't afford to put her in a nursing facility even if they
want to. That's exactly right. They're taking care of their mother who has very, very advanced dementia. They can't afford to put her in a facility. They can't really afford to have someone take care of her, but it's clearly a challenge and it's not going to get better. But what they've done is they've set their daughters on a path that has distinguished them. And when Eric finds out that Bridget, his younger daughter, Bridget, played by Daisy Egan, is her boyfriend is actually a trust fund kid. It sets this other man. It Eric's the ego, I'm playing the part. I can hardly articulate it now. I'm getting so upset.
It's the closest we get to an outburst.
It just makes him feel even smaller and even less powerful. So these differences are acute. However, these kids are high achievers, and yet they, as you say, there's student loan involved. You know, the student loan, crushing student loan debt for one of them, plus the fact that her, you know, obviously expensive because she refused to go to a state school, mm-hmm. as her father likes to point out. Their obviously expensive, you know, education is not resulting in the stellar musician's career that she had anticipated. And the other daughter, who suffers, you know, from a disease of the colon, is like a lawyer, and yet she, because she's ill, the company is probably not going to carry her, and she's in danger of losing her job. So the thing about it is no matter how much higher you get up on the ladder, you are still going to face these challenges because it's life. And he's created these beautiful, beautiful crises for all these characters to deal with.
When you talked about the fact that, you know, the parents don't even blink an eye at the fact that one of their daughters is attracted to women and she's just broken up with her girlfriend, the other is living with a man of color. what I thought was really interesting and what I thought about after was, yes, we see this is completely, this is don't blink, this is everyday stuff. And I wondered what that looked like 3 years before, maybe when they first learned these things. And I wondered what the sort of crisis moment was when they decided, because certainly I think that Eric and Deirdre weren't the kind of people who imagined that this would be the course right. their daughters' lives would take, and then sort of had to realize, oh, well, this is actually fine.
I think that one of the very intelligent things that Stephen has done in precisely this area of the play is that he's confounded our sort of innate prejudice against certain groups of people assuming that they will behave in certain ways socially. Because the parents are devout Catholics does not in and of itself necessarily mean that they are not going to support their daughters in their what would seem apparently, you know, or would be problematic relationships and life choices. You know, at the head of these marches, and historically at the head of these marches, you know, you will see people from people of faith and people, you know, from traditions that you would not normally expect. I mean, especially in terms of Catholic activism all the way down the years, you know, from the days of Dorothy Day and all that. So it would be very easy to say, well, you know, they're religious people, they're Catholics. Naturally, they disapprove, you know, they're an older generation of Americans, so they disapprove. But that's not what makes up America. The absolute divisions of our country are, these boundaries are more porous than we're used to thinking nowadays. And he's made that very clear. I think it's a wonderful statement about the fact that there are more gray areas here than we think in our lives.
They may be the only family with sort of intergenerational cultural differences that doesn't get in an argument about politics over the dinner table at Thanksgiving. But I wonder if you all, as a cast of actors, talked about how this aspect of their lives might influence the people you're playing.
I think it's a wonderful thing that he didn't get into politics in the play, because then it's going to, because you become, then the play immediately endorses an us and them mentality. Mm-hmm. And some people in the audience are going to be more drawn to these characters if they're on one side, and some of them will feel alienated from them, and hence they won't be able to experience the purely human aspect of the play, which for him is much more important than any particular political situation. I mean, I think that the parents come from Scranton, Pennsylvania. It's very clear that the kids are progressive-minded. But I think it's also entirely possible that the parents are a sort of old-school Democrat, you know, working-class family.
The kind of union blue-collar.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly so. There isn't a sense of the lack of judgment about these kids and their progressive ideas. It seems to be congenial to that kind of the parents being, you know, that way. The only political statement really in the play, which isn't a political statement, is when Deirdre, my wife, is talking about zombie shows and how horrifying it is. And the daughter says, well, she doesn't like to watch anything with blood and gore. And Deirdre says, there's enough happening going on in the world right now to give me the creeps. And that's just about it. And mm-hmm. everybody kind of knows that's what that is. But again, this wonderful playwright decides never to hit anything on the head with a hammer, you know. And like, the play is funny until it isn't.
Yeah. So I want to talk about Momo, who is Eric's mother. She's on the set pretty much the entire time, unless she's taken off to, you know, go use the bathroom. It feels to me like this is she's not quite the gun in the first act, but everybody's headed that direction, right?
Well, she is kind of the gun in the first act, I think. And played by Lauren Klein brilliantly, and she was the Momo in the New York production originally. She's the only member of the original cast who's on the tour with us. And, you know, he plays an interesting trick with Momo in the play, in that she's sweet and she's cute and she's funny, and we kind of laugh. There's a lot of laughter around her behavior while it's benign. But then as with all the characters at the end, you know, he allows us to see that part of her existence, which is painful and tortured. And one of the things that he's done, I think, dramaturgically that's so effective is that he's allowed in the first three quarters of the play, he's allowed us to laugh so much and feel poignantly, but to laugh so much and to enjoy these people being together so much that we feel like we really get to know them and we are enjoying them. He lets us have that experience before the play begins to turn dark in terms of what's going on with the characters. So that by the time things are difficult for everybody, we've earned the audience's care.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience feels, I think, even more implicated in and affected by the crisis of the characters because he's allowed us so much time just to watch them behaving so wonderfully together.
Early in the play, I think it's Bridget who says, oh, I forgot about Momo being in a wheelchair.
Right.
And Deidre says, yeah, of course you did.
Exactly.
And throughout the rest of the production, I was thinking about, are these adults in their 60s thinking, will these girls be there to take care of us? Will they be even prepared to provide for us when we can't provide for ourselves?
I think that it's interesting. It's a great question, and it's actually never occurred to me in the course of the performance, mainly because I think Eric and Deirdre are the kind of people who have spent so much time taking care of other people that they haven't really thought much about who's going to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Deirdre is a volunteer with Bhutanese,
right.
people in her community, and she's
not
like,
laughing at that. It's a laugh line in the show.
Yeah, exactly. It's and Eric, they tease each other mercilessly but lovingly all the way through, which is one of the beauties of the play is how they it brings back into play raillery, the wonderful ability to tease and criticize with love and with a sense of camaraderie and respect. You can push people pretty far as long as they know that you're doing it in a loving way. I mean, you can really challenge each other, and this family really knows how to do that. And I think it's one of the joys of the play. People are so sensitive about offense and with good reason. It's nice to see a family that can really push each other on top of the foundations of real love and acceptance.
Yeah, because you get the sense that they wouldn't have much of anything to say to each other if they didn't find a way to talk about the things that are hard.
Yeah, I mean, Eric has to do that thing that all parents hate doing with his daughter Bridget when he has to sort of throw some cold water on her face about how discouraged she is about her work as a young musician, and he has to just sort of hit her with that and say, look, you know, if you're lucky to have a calling, a passion, and if you don't care about it enough to push through a setback, then you should really quit and do something else. No parent wants to say that to a kid, but they're able to withstand that, you know, and the relationship that he has with Amy, the older daughter played by Teresa Plain, you know, has to do with this unspoken, this undiscussed event that they share, which is a tragedy on 9/11, where she was in one of the buildings and he had taken her there for an interview, and he was at a across the street at a Dunkin' Donuts when the buildings came down, and she was up on the 37th floor, and they found each other eventually, but can you imagine what that would have been like? And so that has never really been accounted for in their relationship, and there is some measure of connection at the end about that.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is actor Richard Thomas, who plays Eric Blake in the touring production of The Humans, which is in Dallas now as part of its national tour. You have been working nonstop since 1959.
I know.
Which is almost 60
actually,
years.
I
58,
think.
Okay.
It started in Sunrise in Campobello, I think, started in 58.
I mean, do you always feel like you chose your career or like it was chosen for you and you grew into it?
Both. I mean, I was, you know, my parents were ballet dancers. I was a backstage baby.
Mm-hmm.
There are pictures of me sleeping in trunks backstage at the various opera houses around the world. And then I had an opportunity to get on stage when I was even younger, when I was six at a summer stock production. And I loved it. It made me happy. It seemed the most natural thing in the world, you know, to just that was the life I was going to have. Although because of my propensity for talking, the idea of being a dancer in a profession where you couldn't open your mouth on stage is inconceivable to me even then, I think. So I started very young. I was lucky. I had the ridiculous luck of having a first grade teacher who happened to be a children's agent and who took me in for an audition for a play about the Roosevelt family, Sunrise at Campobello. And that was my first Broadway show, my first show as a member of Equity. And then right after that, there were the live Hallmark shows. There were all those live television shows that were done in the East in the 50s. And so I really cut my teeth in front of the camera doing live TV, which was a great learning experience for a child actor.
It seems like if you learn how to do live TV as a kid, there's nothing will ever scare you, right?
Well, it's true. I mean, because it combines the great thing about learning during that period of live TV in what they used to call, before now we're in a new golden age of television, they say, but what they used to call the golden age was that, you know, it was the technique of film and camera technique and stage technique sort of combined, because you would rehearse like you're rehearsing a play. You'd come, you know, you'd meet in a rehearsal room, rehearse for several weeks, and work it out as if you were doing a play, which you don't get to do when you're preparing a film. But then when you got to do it, you had to play straight through, and yet you had to understand what the cameras were doing, and it was a camera performance. So you weren't projecting the way you would in a stage. You had to be aware of where the cameras were. You had to sort of jump from set to set as the cameras moved, and it was really interesting, and it taught a lot about both techniques. It was a wonderful hybrid.
Yeah, it almost sounds like you were raised bilingual. You know, like people who have no trouble with two languages because they've always spoken them. You had that literacy of performing.
Yeah, it's a unique thing to have learned it, not just to do film and television, but to have done sort of this hybrid version of both. Also, there were so many theater people involved in television in those days. I mean, you know, the 12 Angry Men, which the last time I was in Dallas with a show, you know, everybody says, oh, I love that play. I've always loved that play. Well, it was never a play. It was a television show. It was a television play, a live TV play that was turned into a movie, you know, with Henry Fonda and a lot of great actors. And then that script was turned into a play by Reginald Rose, who wrote the original television script. So there was the dramaturgy of those early, the teleplays, those early, you know, live dramas, was really, it was theatrical dramaturgy. It was written by playwrights. And many of the actors, because it was New York, were all theater actors, and many of them went out to become, you know, film stars and, you know, but it was a fantastic sort of fantastic nest to grow up in.
My guest is actor Richard Thomas. He plays Eric Blake in the Tony Award-winning play The Humans, which is touring nationally and is currently in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink, or you can email think@kera.org. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with actor Richard Thomas. He portrays Eric Blake in the Tony Award-winning play The Humans, which is on a national tour coming through Dallas currently. You were talking about the kind of ways you learn to use your voice as a very young actor and your body. I noticed right away that you are not body mic'd in this production of The Humans. You are.
We are body mic'd.
Doesn't sound like you are.
Well, it's one of the things. I mean, sometimes I have to turn my mic off, unfortunately, because the size of my voice, especially when it's in a acoustically great house like this Windspear. When you're doing a tour, I don't like being mic'd. I think most actors who work in the theater don't. I mean, I have a strong voice simply because for decades I worked, you know, I worked on stage for decades before anyone ever put a mic on me. When you had to reach the back row and the top of the balcony. But when you're on a tour and you go from you know, last week in Charlotte, North Carolina, we were in a 1,200-seat house, and now we're in the Windspear. You know, after this, we'll be in at Gamage in Tempe, Arizona, which is 3,000 seats. So with the varying acoustics of each theater and the different size of the house, you can't really, if you were constantly pushing and then pulling back to accommodate these different venues, it would be very taxing, number one, on the actors' voices. And number two, everybody's voice is set in a different place. Mm-hmm. So it would be, you know, it would be easier to hear some people than others, depending on whether there's a high-pitched voice or all this technical stuff. But what mics do is that they allow us, I mean, we still project. I mean, we project as if we did not wear mics. But what the mics do is the technicians are able to balance our voices in whatever venue we happen to be in.
Mm-hmm.
But that house, the Windspear, is so live, has so much wood in it, and it's such a warm sound, and it's built obviously for singing for voices. It would be very easy for me to play that house without a mic, even though it's a very, you know, it's a big house for a play. But we are in fact mic'd, yeah.
So I love the Windspear. I've never had a bad experience there, but it is a very large space for a really intimate show.
It's not a playhouse.
This feels like an off-Broadway kind of size production. Is there a kind of theater that sort of wraps around this production that feels just right to you, with all due respect to everywhere that you're taking this tour?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and it's one of the challenges and excitements of being on these tours. We started at the Seattle Rep. In Seattle, which is obviously in Seattle, which is like a 700-seat house, which is kind of ideal for a play. And then we went to one of my favorite theaters in the country, the Eisenhower at the Kennedy Center, which is 1,200 seats. We were at a 1,200-seat house in Charlotte. Playhouses are different from these big, beautiful palaces that were built for movies and vaudeville and all that, you know. And so it sits less comfortably in the great big houses. We're not playing the Fox in Atlanta, but when we did with 12 Angry Men, it was like radio. I mean, we were just—it was really like radio. Thank God we were mic'd. But the Windspear is different because I think, although I haven't seen anything from the house, because the acoustic is so good, that I would hope that the experience the audience has, no matter where they sit, is an intimate one. In terms of the voices, which is really the most important thing. It's not, but you're right. It's an intimate play. It's a small play. It's a play that draws you in, and it's more challenging in a larger house for sure.
So, spoiler alert for anyone who's a couple seasons behind on The Americans, your character, Agent Frank Gadd, was killed off in 2016 at the end of the season.
At the end of season four.
Do you stay invested in that after as a viewer? Or are you just done because you kind of miss your coworkers?
Well, you know, when you're done, you're kind of done. Uh-huh. I mean, with a show. I mean, I love the show. It's a great show, and I'm very excited to wait till. I can't really, it's not easy for me to watch things like that on the tour when I'm yeah. but when I'm done and I'm home, I'm going to watch the whole last season and see what happens. But yeah, I mean, I loved that show. And one of the reasons I loved that character was for the reason I love Eric Blake. It's really not, you go, oh yes, let's get Richard Thomas for that part. You know, that's sort of the most counterintuitive casting you could imagine for me to play the head of, you know, an FBI boss. But my friend Joel Fields, who was one of the creators, called me and said, look, we're doing this show and we've got this part of this FBI chief, but we don't want to have the usual guy. You know, we want somebody who would be very different. So would you be interested? And of course I was. It's been a wonderful experience. And I had a good death. You know, they could have just fired me, but they killed me instead, which is always, it's always better to have a good exit, you know. I mean, and it's a cable series, so basically everybody dies, right? I mean, you know you're going to get that. You know you're going to get that call. Richard, we want to talk to you. So, okay, am I on death row now? Yeah.
Well, you've really been doing TV from like the original golden era of television through the times when, you know, TV wasn't so respected.
Right.
Back to this current golden era.
I know. Well, I was really lucky because I was in this golden age as a child. And then in this period in the 70s, I was in one of the shows that was considered a great television show, The Waltons. I mean, which was really sort of, you know, that was great TV. And it wasn't like any other show, and it was copied by a lot of things after that. But so even in that other period, I felt like here we were in this. I got a chance to be in a terrific piece of television. And now it's just the medium is completely transformed.
I don't know if you ever turn on, you know, open the box set of the Waltons or whatever, but can you see a difference in your abilities as an actor from the time you started on that series until the time it ended?
Oh, my God, of course. It's very, I mean, watching, I think for most actors, you know, watching yourself is not a pleasurable experience. It's a macabre. It's not natural. It's a weird thing. You know, it's like the first time you hear your voice on a tape recording when you're a kid. You go, I don't sound like that. That's not me. But one, you know, yeah, I feel that so much of those early performances, there's a kind of a rawness and an uncareful quality about them. There's a whole lot of acting going on.
Like obvious acting.
Just a whole lot of acting. Just sort of
overflowing. What were you, 19 when you started?
I was 21 when I started that show. But that's appropriate for those parts, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, I have to do a lot of instant forgiveness when I see clips from the Waltons, because I think, well, that was John Boy, and he was that sort of passionate, raw, uncareful person who was full of feeling, and, you know, and as such, actually, a very new and different kind of male character television. Really the first of his kind in a drama, who was basically a feeling and thinking male hero of a television series, an introvert who was, you know, obviously, you know, very out there with his feelings. So I have to forgive myself a lot for my, you know, for my youthful, for my, you know, juvenilia.
It's interesting, you know, now you really embody this working class character, maybe somewhere between working class and middle class. I can't quite.
Well, that's part of the thing about the play.
Right.
One of the things about the play is, where do you place these people on the economic scale? It's all crumbling and compressing. You know, they would at one point be called middle class, but are they now working class, that are slightly better off working class, but they're having financial crisis? So where does that, you know, it's a very complicated issue, economic strata. And this play, again, in his kind of sideways way, he addresses it.
I was thinking about a lot of people making art about this in-between class of people, and mm-hmm. often they have maybe some roots there, but they haven't stayed there. I mean, you have been very successful for a very long time. I don't know if you have, like, Brad Pitt money, but your life is forgive me because I say this with respect.
From your lips to God's
your
ears.
Your life has been pretty privileged for some time now.
Yeah, of course it has.
So how do you really get a sense, how do you know that you're getting it right?
Getting it right?
Yeah.
Oh, you don't get it right. Getting it right.
How do you make decisions that feel right to you?
You mean
for this
in terms
character?
Of career? Or
no. Just... Like in terms of sort of really understanding the mental workings of someone like Eric Blake.
Oh, like Eric. You know, the beauty of the thing that makes it possible. I mean, in fact, I'm an actor, and sort of our job is to imagine ourselves into the lives of people who are. You know, I'm certainly not Iago, but it was one of the best experiences I ever had on the stage. The common experience of humanity being the sort of baseline of this play allows someone like me, who was a theater kid, you know, a theater brat, and growing up in New York City, and, you know, and then a fortunately successful actor for many, many years, to imagine myself into the world of Eric, precisely because of the emotional veracity of the writing. Mm. You know, there's a baseline human feeling. The challenge for me was not about imagining myself into his more quotidian experience, but to just slow down and be quiet and be silent and to not be as kinetic as I usually am on stage. Joe Mantello, our wonderful director, was like, okay, Richard, slow down. I mean, I've known him forever. We've known each other for many, many, many years. Like, slow down. Don't, you know, because I'm fast on stage and I'm always very available with all kinds of stuff. And Eric is a guy who's got it all behind here. You know, his cards are very close to his chest. So that was, but once I could settle into the physical life of this guy and let my posture go and let my core go and...
Yeah, physically you're kind of unrecognizable, honestly,
yes,
on stage.
Thank you. I mean, and that really, once I was able to wear those dad jeans and that oversized sweater and just kind of slump into the inner, the feeling, the physical feeling of this man and his feet on the ground. The rest of it was, it really came. And there are always all sorts of ways into a performance. Sometimes you work from the inside out, and sometimes there are physical cues that help, that open up a floodgate of feelings and insights. And so I really had to slow down and stop and get over an awful lot of my usual acting stuff to play this part. And it's been very satisfying to have a challenge like this after so many years, is just in terms of the way you set about doing a character. It's just a wonderful experience for me. Also the writing, the text is, the overlapping naturalistic style of the text is incredibly challenging.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You mentioned earlier that on The Americans, it wasn't the kind of part that people would typically say, get that Richard Thomas in
exactly.
here. What kind of part do they call you in on every time?
I'm a young writer living in the hills of Virginia in the 1920s. What can I say?
Because you've done so many different things. It's almost like, as much as I know that you've embraced the character, you've spent the rest of your career proving that that's not the only thing you can play.
Yeah, I mean, one wants, in part because that's the delight of acting.
Yeah.
You know, that's the pleasure. The pleasure one takes as a child in make-believe and imagination is precisely the pleasure that you take as an actor in doing very different kinds of parts. That's why it's fun. That's why comedians always want to play serious, and why, you know, serious actors want to be able to land a joke, and why, you know, we strive to find that communion between ourselves and another character, right, with the ways in which we are the same, that allows us to bridge the gap of the ways in which we are different. Right. So, I mean, if you're playing Iago, because I've mentioned it, it's like, OK, I want to find my commonality with this monster so that I can jump across the gap of period and time, or the whatever the production is, and the way this man acts, his actions, and find that inner commonality. And, you know, it can be terrifying if you're playing a part like that, you know, what you find in yourself. But it's part of the joy of it. You know, it's it's a pleasure to take on those different parts.
You have a really youthful affect. You still look really young. I would imagine you've got about a 20 to 25 year age span of things you can play. Women often complain about the lack of really meaningful roles
yeah.
past a certain age. Do you feel that as a man as well?
No, I think women have had a hard road that way. I don't think there's any comparison. Women, I mean, actors, if they have consistently continued to work, if they have tried to get better, you know, and tried to learn and do better, they just get richer. The opportunity to give richer and deeper performances is enhanced. But then, if there are fewer roles to be able to display this maturity as a performer, it's very sad. And women actresses have really been at a disadvantage. I think there's some change in that because, and also if you look back at the history of acting, I mean, ever since from the time women were actually allowed to be on stage,
right?
Well, has to take that into consideration. Actresses have been historically celebrated, the great actresses, every bit as much as the great actors. Certainly from the 19th, in the late 18th, and then the 19th centuries. So this paucity of roles for mature actresses is a scandal.
Actor Richard Thomas has been in hundreds of TV shows, movies, and plays. Currently, he plays Eric, the father of two adult daughters, in the Tony Award-winning touring production of The Humans. The play is in Dallas as part of that national tour. Richard, it's been great to speak with you. Thank you for making time for us.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much. And you've spoken so insightfully about the play. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. And I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.